For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're continuing on. We're in Luke chapter 6 again. And we've been talking about Jesus's battle with religion. That, he is not who the religious authorities expected the Messiah to be. He's been preaching about relationship over and over and over again. Talking to people about God's love, about what it means to have a personal relationship with God. Taking on the religious ceremonies and rituals that had become dead letter rituals that people followed out of blind obedience without understanding the meaning behind it, and challenging the religious authorities. He's been hanging out with sinners because he says, hey, it's the sick who need a doctor. I came here to heal, and I'm here to help these people. And he's been taking on the religious establishment. That he is sort of this countercultural revolutionary within Israel at this time, and it's the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious authorities, the religious rulers of Jesus's day, who are having a real problem with him. And we saw last week they were, after he started forgiving people's sins and healing on the Sabbath, now they're even talking about potentially killing him. And then all of a sudden, all these people, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the people in the society that know that they're sinful, that know that they're living their lives the wrong way, are being drawn to Christ in huge numbers. And their lives are being changed. They're being healed, not only physically, but spiritually, because of the teachings and the person of Jesus Christ. And so we start in Luke chapter 6. 12 through 19, and we read, it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when he came, he called his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles. So he's got a group of people that are following him, and he's picking out 12 of them to invest in a special way. Simon, whom he called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who will become a traitor. Jesus came down with them and stood on a level place, and there was a large crowd of his disciples and a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were being cured, and all the people were trying to touch him, for the power was coming from him and healing them all. And so there's this summary of the way that Jesus is working. He's teaching, he's healing, but he's also picking certain numbers, certain men to invest in a deep and special way. And he's calling them apostles. And this is an important part of Jesus' strategy for changing the world. And we see that it says that he stood on a level place. That right there is the only reason that what we're about to read next is sometimes called the Sermon on the Plain. It's a famous teaching of Jesus. It has a corollary in Matthew that's sometimes called the Sermon on the Mount. And that's why it's called that. But we go and we look and we realize that in Jesus' battle to hold forth the idea of relationship over religion, that he has this important strategy of discipleship. He's going to invest himself strategically in a very special way. He teaches, and he teaches to the masses. And that's good, and that's important. That's causing people to think about their lives, causing people to think about God and their relationship with God. But he's going to bring certain men around him to have a special kind of friendship, a special kind of relationship. You know, he could have just said to those guys, make sure you're at all my public teachings, if that were sufficient and helping to raise them up to be used by God to carry on his mission. But he doesn't do that. He says, I want you at my side. I want you to be with me at all times. And so they're going to eat together. They're going to drink together. They're going to sleep together. They're going to travel together. And they're going to have a close-knit relationship. And then it is because that is how God most powerfully works in our lives, is through relationship. So he trained them, and his idea, which they didn't even necessarily understand at the time, was they were going to become ambassadors for him to carry on his teaching and his work after his resurrection and ascension. And so after he chooses them, he gathers them together, and in this thing that theologians call the Sermon on the Plain, what we have, and it's important to understand this because the context makes it very clear. Jesus has just gathered his disciples, and now he's going to give a teaching, and this teaching is to his disciples. There are other people around, other people are permitted to listen, but the audience for this particular teaching on Jesus' part is his disciples. Look right here, starting in chapter 6, verse 20, he says, "And turning his gaze toward his disciples, he began to say, 'Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you and insult you and scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way their fathers used to treat the prophets.'" And so we have four blessings. Blessed are the poor, blessed are those who hunger, blessed are those who weep, and blessed are those who are ostracized. And then it goes on and says, "For the sake of the Son of Man, blah, 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 for in the same way their fathers treat the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you are receiving your comfort in full. And woe to you who are well fed now, for you shall be hungry. And woe to you who laugh, for you shall mourn and weep. And woe to you when all men speak well of you, for their fathers used to treat the false prophets in the same way." And so we had four blessings, and now we have four corresponding woes. And it's a little bit confusing. It's a little bit strange. When we put them next to each other and we look at these blessings and these woes, we see a parallelism between them. We have the poor and the rich, the hungry and the well-fed, the weeping and the laughing, and the hated and the well-liked. Four blessings and four woes. The thing that's really disturbing here is the blessings. That doesn't look like blessing, does it? You know, who wants to be in that column? This one looks pretty good. And he says, these guys, woe to them, and blessings on the other ones. And we begin to wonder a little bit if Jesus, what is he doing? Why is he using these terms? And what do these terms even mean? What does it mean, blessing? What is it that Jesus is saying here? Well, in the Greek, the original language here, in which this is being written, this word blessing is makarios. And it means something that's a little bit different. Blessing is an awfully churchy word, isn't it? What is a blessing? How is it that God is going to bless you? You know, we say that when someone sneezes, but what does it mean to be blessed? And the word makarios actually means to be fulfilled, to be content, and to be whole. There's a sense of completeness to this. And so when he says, you know, blessed are the poor, in some way he's saying if you're poor, you're complete, you're whole, and you're content, which makes even less sense, really, if you think about it. On the other hand, there's these woes. Now, woe is a serious word. It seems to have a very serious connotation. Woe, as Americans, we know we want to avoid woe. We don't use that word very often, but what does it mean? The word in the Greek here is awahi. And it means to be grieved, but literally translated, it means what sorrow awaits. What sorrow is coming to you? And it's like, okay, so what sorrow is coming to the rich? What sorrow is coming to the well-liked, to the well-fed? We haven't solved our problem here. One of the things, though, that we need to understand, because, you know, these kinds of passages are famous, and we've probably heard them. Even if we didn't go to church, we, you know, saw the life of Brian and heard blessed are the cheesemakers or something like that. That whole blessing, blessed are you, blessed are you, blessed are you, and woe to you, is something that we're not completely unfamiliar with one way or the other. And so we tend to read these things in a certain way, and it's important to understand that these are descriptive terms of spiritual truth that are revealing something about how God has made us. What I mean is it's not directly telling us that God will bless you if you're poor. Like God waves his magic fairy wand if you're poor, right? And says, oh, you're poor. Now I'm going to sprinkle my fairy dust in your life and things that you're going to be happy. That's not what he's saying. Or that God will woe you somehow. You're going to be woed by God if you're rich. And that he's going to look down at you and he's going to judge you. This is not saying, this is not necessarily indicating that God looks at each of these things and says, oh, there's a poor person, I'll bless them. And there's a rich person, I'll curse them. It's saying something about the nature of, if you're poor, in whatever way he means poor, that there's a chance there for fulfillment. And if you're rich, your richness will not fulfill you. It will not make you whole. It will not make you complete. In fact, you can expect sorrow. And so we're moving along and we're trying to understand this. It's still confusing, but he's saying you will be full if you live God's way, Makarios, and you will be empty, woeful, if you live selfishly, Elahi. Okay. Now, the context for this, we already said, was discipleship. And so he's saying a disciple will be full, will be content, will be whole if he is poor, hungry, sad, and hated. Now, that sounds a lot like asceticism. Asceticism is this idea that, you know, somehow you're more holy, you're more spiritual, you're more well-liked by God, and he will wave his magic fairy wand if you suffer. And so that's what God wants. And, you know, people, Christians, other religions have pursued this idea for centuries. You know, the whole idea of wearing a hair shirt, which is crazy. You wear a really itchy shirt and somehow God says, well done. I like you, the cut of your jib, right? Or you throw yourself down a flight of stairs or you sleep on a bed of nails. And that somehow this is, the idea is that you're destroying your flesh, your body is evil, and you're somehow breaking down your flesh and allowing the spirit to come out. And this is an idea that has plagued humanity, well, it's as old as religion itself. And Christianity is no different. Man has interpreted this into the teachings of Jesus. And so you might look at this and you say, well, Jesus is saying, you know, go sell everything and starve and get skinny and make people hate you and then you're blessed. But how does that fit with what we've just studied? As we've been studying through the life of Christ, we've seen that he's actually being rebuked by the religious people of his days for not being ascetic enough. Remember Matthew's party where they're like, how come you don't fast like John? And he was like, Jesus' answer was, hey, fasting is good and all, but the bridegroom is here. This is a time to party. This is a time to rejoice. You know, this is a wedding feast. My bride is coming. And so it's time to be excited and to be fulfilled. And so the idea of asceticism really doesn't fit into really the Old Testament either. The teachings of the Old Testament are not very ascetic. There's a lot of feasting and partying in the Old Testament as well. So why would all of a sudden Jesus get ascetic with his disciples? The other alternative here that makes a lot of sense and that fits much better is what theologians like to call the paradigm of reversal. That there's a way that Jesus has of turning things on his head. And it has to do with perspective. It has to do with priorities. And it has to do with the way that you see the world. He's talking about prioritizing your life according to spiritual values, as opposed to, on the other hand, material values. And all we mean is material values are things that you can taste, touch, see, and smell. They're the things that are very tangible to us in this world. Money is a very material value. And if you make money the most important thing in your life, then you can accumulate lots of money. And the question is, will accumulating lots of money and making money the most important thing in your life, will that make you whole, complete, or will that make you Elahi? Will that make you empty? And does sorrow await you if that's who you are? And we look at this and we see more evidence as we go back and look at this same passage. We have these blessings, and timing apparently is an important issue here with these blessings. He says, "You who hunger now shall be satisfied. You who weep now shall laugh." And so within this formula of these parallel ideas of be hungry or be well fed, be poor or be rich, be well liked or be hated, we see what Jesus is saying is right now it's better to be poor than to be rich. It's better to live your life for things other than money than to live your life for money. But there will come a time where if you live your life for things other than money, that you shall become rich. And we see down here, he talks about that future time, your reward is great in heaven. He's pulling out these ideas and he's saying, are you willing to sacrifice these values now in order to get a much greater eternal reward later? And then he turns and turns it back on its head and he goes back and he says, but if you're well fed now, you shall be hungry. If you laugh now, you shall mourn and weep, for you are receiving your comfort in full. So if we understand this, and we understand what these ideas are, we begin to see the very important truth that what Jesus is talking about is, what do you live your life for now, and what will the results of that life mean later? Will you be whole? Will you be complete? Will you be well fed? Will you be laughing? Will you inherit the kingdom of God? Or will you be hungry? Will you be empty? Will you be remorseful about wasting your life? That's what Jesus is talking about. And a disciple of Christ must understand that there is much more at stake than comfort in this life. Much more at stake. Epicurus was a Greek philosopher in the 300s BC. And remember, we talked when we started this whole series about how influenced Jewish culture had been by Greek culture. How Alexander the Great came in, and the Ptolemies, and the Seleucids, and the Maccabean Revolt. We talked about all that, right? We haven't forgotten that stuff because it's so important. Jesus' audience here is a Jewish audience, but they've been heavily influenced by Greek philosophy. Epicurus, or Epicureanism, is one of the most popular and most powerful Greek ideas. And this guy Epicurus had what was called the tetrapharmakos, which means the four cures. And his philosophy basically worked like this. It had four components. The first was, don't fear God. And the reason you don't fear God is because God doesn't care about you. You know, in his case, it would be gods. But he was like, either they don't exist or they're not involved. We've never met them. No one's ever met them. They're uninvolved. So don't worry about the gods. Worry about what you can see, what you could taste, what you could touch, what you could smell. Those are the things that are important. This whole spiritual thing, it's nonsense. And don't worry about death. Because when you die, you won't experience that. Death is the end of your experiences, and so there's no need to fear it. It's inevitable, it's going to come, and once it does, you won't even know. So don't worry about death. What is good is easy to get. Food, clothing, and shelter is what you need. It's what your life should be about. Pursue those things, those simple things, and don't worry about pain. What is terrible is easy to endure, because eventually it'll get better, or it'll kill you, and you won't know the difference. All pain is temporary, so don't worry about it. It'll either, joy and sweetness will either return or you'll die. Here's a direct quote from his letter to Menesius, which says, death means nothing to us. When we exist, death is not yet present. And when death is present, we do not exist. So don't worry about death. This is literally the school that eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die comes from. And it's not all that dissimilar to our culture today. Our culture today basically says, he who dies with the most stuff wins. You know, build your life be comfortable, avoid pain, avoid suffering, try to pad your nest and your 401k and your retirement account and provide for yourself, get a good house and a good school system and a safe car, and everything will be in a nice, right, shiny package of protection and comfort for you and the people that you love. And if you live your life for that, you'll be happy. It's Epicureanism. Jesus, on the other hand, says exactly the opposite thing. In Matthew 6, 19 through 21, he says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasure on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasure in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Could he be any more on the opposite extreme of Epicurus? He's saying, actually, this life doesn't matter all that much. It's the next life that matters a great deal. But there are things that you can do in this life that will carry over into the next. And it's not investing in your 401k. It's investing in relationships. It's investing in love. It's being used by God in the lives of other people. That has eternal value. And so you can take temporal things like money or like time or like energy, and you can invest it in people, and that comes out with an eternal reward that can never be taken away. Whereas your money, your house, your car, your fancy things, well, they often and always, in fact, become moth food. So why make those things the center of your life? And so when Jesus says, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God," what he's saying, though, here is, if you live as though this world is not your world, if you live with your priorities and your values in line with God's values and God's priorities, you will experience fullness. Matthew 6:24 says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other." You cannot serve God and wealth. What's going to be the most important thing in your life? The world offers you wealth. As Americans, there is no one who is more exposed and more offered wealth in the world than you. You and I, no matter how poor we are by American standards, are wealthy by world standards. And is wealth going to be your God? Is it going to be the thing that when you wake up in the morning, you are motivated to go get more, to have more, to pad yourself more, more security, more comfort, then you're serving wealth as your God, and woe to you. What sorrow awaits. If you live this life for money, Jesus says, why? You're missing the point. And you're going to come to the end of this life having received your comfort in full. How sorrowful will you be when the veil is lifted and everything becomes crystal clear about what life is, about who God is, about what the world is, about why we spend the time here that we do, the short, precious time in the face of eternity that we have that we call life, has a meaning and a purpose behind it, and it ain't comfort. It's so sad how people live their whole lives and sometimes never figure this out. It's tragic when they figure it out at the very end. You know, when you spend time with people who are older and who have lived their lives in their 80s and 90s, and, you know, if you go to a retirement village and you talk with people there, one of the things that you see are there are basically two kinds of people. There are people that are pretty happy, pretty engaged, and pretty grateful for their lives and for their relationships. And there are people that are utterly and destitutely alone. And one thing you can absolutely be sure of is no one comes to the end of their life thinking, man, I just wish I worked more and I'd made more money. The regrets that are there are not that. The regrets that are there are, I wish I would have spent more time with my children. I wish I would have spent more time with my spouse. I wish I would have built more friendships. Because it's at the end of life where the veil comes back a little bit and we begin to see what's really important. And God says, by the way, those are the things that are eternal. Those are the things that go on. Your true wealth, to be rich, and the true sense of eternity is to have friends and connections and love relationships with people, because that's all you bring with you into the next life. So woe to you. What sorrow awaits you if you live your life as though money is the most important thing. If you live your life with spiritual values and you prioritize the things that God says are important, Makarios, yours is the kingdom of heaven. You've invested in the right things. And when all things become clear and all things become apparent, you will see that there is quite an investment, quite an inheritance waiting for you as a result of the things that you did and the priorities you had in this life. He says, blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be satisfied. In other words, if you're willing to forsake comfort and even material needs, even the things that you need to survive, if you're willing to sacrifice those in this life in order to accomplish something of value in the next, in order to move forward and be able to move forward in love, sacrificing not just out of what you have left over, but what out of what you need, that's Makarios. Luke 9:23 through 25, he says, and he was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. For what does a man profit if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? It's a fantastic question. You know, and what he's saying here is not pick up your cross like we would today and our little gold crosses and put it on and, you know, I'm a Christian. No. He's talking about the crosses of his day. There were no, you know, it would be like wearing a little electric chair around your neck, you know, and saying, you know, this is me. That would make no sense to them whatsoever. The cross was a symbol of terror and pain. And he's saying, pick up your cross. Be ready to follow in my footsteps and to suffer the way that I have suffered if you want to follow me. Because this life is a battle. This life is a war. And we're not going to sit on the sidelines drinking cups of tea. We're going to get into the muck. And we're going to lift up the people who dwell in darkness. And we're going to pay a heavy price for it. Because the world is not going to let these people go easily. And Jesus knew that better than anyone else. Are you willing to sacrifice your comfort? On the other hand, if you feed every appetite, if every time you have an urge, every time you have a hunger, you say yes, awahi. What sorrow awaits you, you will always be hungry. If all you do is eat, and all you do is consume, and all you do is take, all you'll experience in life is hunger. Hunger for more. I love it in The Simpsons when Mr. Burns, the rich evil guy, says, you know, they're like, oh, Mr. Burns, you're so rich and wealthy. And he says, ah, yes, but I'd trade it all for a little bit more. That's the attitude of people who live this way. They always, how much is enough? It's never enough. Because when money and comfort become your God, all you can do is strive after more money and more comfort, and you miss life. You miss relationships. You miss your kids growing up. You miss growing old with your spouse. You miss the sweetness of human compassion and connection and love, and you wind up cold and dark and alone. And you get bitter and you get angry. But it's all your fault. Awahi. What sorrow awaits you. However, if you sacrifice your comfort so that others can be full, Makarios, you will know true wholeness. You will know satisfaction by going without so that others can have, by lifting one another up, by picking up your cross and following after Jesus. You will become what God made you to be, and in you will be a fullness and a wholeness and a greatness that nothing else in life can come close to. No satisfaction. There is no satisfaction like being used by God in the lives of other people, like sacrificing your comfort so that others can be loved and comforted. It's what you were made for. It was what you were built for. I know it doesn't seem that way when you look in your heart. You're like, actually, that's not the message I'm getting when I look inward, Ryan. And I understand, because we're broken and we're fallen and we have what we call a flesh nature. But God says, if you try it and you depend on me, you'll be surprised, Makarios. You'll be blessed. Blessed are those who weep, for they shall laugh. Allow yourself to be touched by the tragedy of the human dilemma. The world sucks. There is pain, there is darkness, there is bitterness, there is rape, there is murder, there is theft, there are lies. There is so much pain and suffering in this world that it's tempting to just shields up, block it all out. Try to create a hedge of protection, a wall of protection around the people that are most important to you in this life, and keep them safe and keep the bad stuff out and the bad people out, and just hold on for dear life and live in the illusion that the world is a beautiful place. And Jesus says, don't do that. Instead, consider weeping, because the world in its state is worth weeping over. The pain that is out there is something that we dare not shield ourselves from, because if we shield ourselves from the pain that is out there, we are living false lives. We're not living in reality. In Luke 13, 34 through 35, Jesus says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not have it. Behold, your house has left you desolate, and I say to you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Jesus looked out at the world and he wept at it, because it had rejected him, it had rejected its maker, and it had chosen darkness and selfishness and evil. And the people were suffering. And he allowed the suffering of this world, he allowed himself to be exposed to the suffering of this world. He didn't wall himself off. And he wept. And he says, if you want to be my disciple, you're going to have to weep too. You're going to have to weep at the pain in this world. The alternative is to harden your hearts to the suffering of others. And this is so easy to do as Americans. But if you harden your heart to the sufferings of others, awahi, what sorrow awaits? You will mourn and you will weep when you realized how you turned your backs on the sufferings of others. When the veil is pulled back and you realize what this world is about and what really mattered and what really counted and what was really important and what you could have done to make a difference, you will weep. Jesus doesn't want that for you. We don't want that for you. We want fullness and completeness and wholeness. If you weep and allow yourself to be touched by the pain of others, Makarios, you're full, you're content, and you're whole. And he says you will laugh when the pain and suffering of this world is wiped away. God, what a day. What a day it will be when we look at the pain and the suffering and the hardship of this world, and on one day, it'll die. And what will be left is goodness and love and light and joy. This is one of my favorite verses in all of Scripture. Revelation 21, 3 through 4, and I heard a loud voice coming from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, no pain, mourning, or crying, for the first things have passed away. I've got some tears that I want wiped away, and I know that you do too. And so we can weep now for the pain and the suffering that we see in the world, because we are promised by God that we will laugh. We will laugh with joy when sin dies a terrible death and all that is left is the glory of God and our relationships with each other. Disciples of Christ have to understand this. They have to know. They have to know as you move out into the muck and the darkness where the pedophiles live and the rapists and the murderers. When you move out into that world, you have to have, above all other things, you have to have hope. You have to know that something good is coming, that it's not always going to be this way, and that you can make a difference now. Maybe not in the entire world, but in your life, in the lives of the people that you touch, you can make a difference. And there will come a time where there is none of this any longer, and there is only goodness, and there is only God, and there is only love, and that's the way it's going to look for the rest of eternity. You'd be amazed at what you can endure if you remember that. What can you endure if you wall yourself off from the hardship and the pain and the evil of this world? You become weak. You become soft. You become disconnected. It's woeful. It's a wahi. Blessed are you who are hated because of your faith, for your reward in heaven will be great. Putting God's love and truth before being popular or accepted by friends, neighbors, and co-workers, he says, is a good thing. 2 Cor 5:20-21, therefore we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were making an appeal through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. We're not above begging. We're not above pleading. We're not above begging you in the name of God to consider asking Jesus Christ into your life. When we move towards the world in faith and we place the values of God, the love of God, the heart of God, and the message of God, and the message of Jesus Christ on the cross, when we place that before our popularity and before our concern about what people are going to think, Macarius, we are blessed, we are whole, we are complete. On the other hand, if you refuse to share God's truth because you're afraid of others' disapproval, awahi. You're going to come to a point in your life where you will mourn and weep at those missed opportunities. Where you will look back and you will realize that you could have been used, but you were scared. Where you could have spoken and you remained silent. There was a period in your existence, in your life here on earth, where you could have stood up and taken a risk that could have rendered eternal rewards in someone else's life. And you skipped it that day because you were afraid that someone might think that you were uncool or a Jesus freak or one of those guys. On the other hand, if you are shunned and ill-treated because of your faith, not because you're a jerk, not because, you know, I hate it when people are like, you know, they're real jerks and they go and they treat people in a real judgmental and self-righteous attitude and then they're like, oh, I'm being so persecuted. It's like, no, you're just a jerk. I'm talking about you step out in love and you receive hate in return. You step out with Christ's love and you receive rejection. That is Macarius. That is a part of becoming content and becoming full and becoming whole. And he says, God will more than make up the difference for you on that one in eternity. That doesn't escape God's eye. When you're rejected and shunned for your faith, for stepping out in love, God, that goes in the ledger, God says. And he's going to more than make it up for us in eternity. So a disciple of Christ knows what this world really is. A disciple of Christ prioritizes their life accordingly. And the question for you this morning is, are you whole? Are you content and filled? Are you going without so that you can give to others? Are you Macarius? Or do you mourn and weep? Are you rich and comfortable and satisfying all of your appetites and wondering, is this all there is to life? Are you woeful? It's not just a question of whether you're a Christian or not. It's a question of whether or not you're a disciple. Are you willing to prioritize your life according to God's values? Or are you destroying yourself and wasting your time with things that lead to emptiness? It's quite a contrast. There's really nothing more, there's no more important discussion we can have than this as followers of Christ. How do we live up? What does it look like? I mean, maybe we're sitting here, we're thinking, well, I kind of want to do those things, but what exactly does it look like? Well, thankfully, Jesus continues in a very practical section after giving us the woes and the blessings. In 6:27 through 38, we're just going to read through this, and I just want you to understand this is a demonstration of these principles at work. He says, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. Whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold from him your shirt either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. Treat others the same way you want them to treat you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that back to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. And do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Pardoned, and you will be pardoned. Give it, and it will be given to you. They will pour together your lap, a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return." That's what it looks like to live that life. Let's be honest, there's no way anyone could live that way. I mean, it's a nice idea, Jesus, thank you. But, you know, we have to live in the real world, right? I mean, that's the easiest thing that happens in our hearts, I think, as we read passages like that. Love your enemies, give to people, and never expect anything to return. I'd be a doormat. People would wipe their feet with me in this world if I did that. Well, it's true. It is true. You cannot live this way on your own. You cannot live Jesus' way, and you cannot live the life of a disciple by your own efforts. It requires supernatural help. It requires a relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's what we need, is a relationship with Jesus, not a religion. Just going to church on Sunday, just putting your money in the basket, you know, just doing your outward forms and rituals of the Pharisees and the Sadducees will not empower you to live this life. But spending time drawing near to Jesus in prayer and in connection and allowing him to come into your life and allowing his priorities to challenge you as you face life's decisions and clinging to other people who are in the same battle for the same reason and coming together as the body of Christ, as the community of Christ, for working together towards this common good in the context of a love relationship with God. It's possible. It won't be perfect because we're still sinners and we're still people, but we can do better. And you would be amazed at the impact of what we could do and the power of a relationship with God. Look at what David, look at how David describes his personal relationship with God in Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of the righteous for his name's sake. Even though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. You are my rod and my staff. They comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's a guy who had a friendship with God. He's known as a man after God's own heart, and he was a sinner. But he loved God, and he saw himself as a sheep. The king of Israel says, I'm a sheep, and when you lead me to a green pasture, I go and I eat. And when you tell me to go rest and lay down and lead me to waters, and when the wolves come and I see reason to be scared, I don't fear because I know that you are with me. And that's the secret to living a life. A life like what God wanted you to live. David was a disciple. He lived his life according to the principles of God, and he was, by and large, Macarius. These blessings and these woes show us this important truth about what will fulfill us and what will make us whole, what will move into our lives and cause us to become the people that we were created to be, or leave us broken and destitute and angry and alone. That will leave us in woe, because God understands what we need and how we were made. They should also serve as a warning to the rich, the well-fed friends of the world. You know, to certain degrees, you and I, we fit into these woeful categories, and we should not miss the fact that there is a warning here. This is not just a description, that there is a sense of danger here. And that danger is that you can live your life and you can be immersed in this world with all this pain and suffering moving on around you, and you could turn a blind eye to the suffering and injustice of a broken world. That should scare us. Not the wrath of God, because the Bible promises us if we have a relationship with God that there is no wrath, but that we would miss, and that we would look back at our life and see more misses, more chances to be used by God that were untaken, than fruit, than the reality of the change that God brings about in our lives. What are the dominant priorities in your life? That's the challenge for you this morning to think about. What are the dominant priorities? What are the things by which you live your life? Does Jesus' blueprint for disciples seem plausible? Or like it's too extreme? It's too far? It's for the religious radicals, you know, maybe for the pastors and the Jesus freaks, but it's not really for me. Well, we'll leave you with this verse. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. There you have beginning of the Sermon on the Plain, Luke chapter 6.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.